Brady 67. I have my contact database, complete with people's physical addresses, email addresses, phone numbers, spouses' names, kids' names, company addresses, and birthday information. I have feeds from news and sports sites that keep me apprised of interesting goings-on. I have texting capability, which allows me to get questions answered or pass along urgent information to those in my relational circle in the span of about 3 seconds. I have one-click access to the World Wide Web, which can tell me anything I don't already know. Heck, I even have a Bible on here, in every translation known to humankind. In fact, I can follow the globe's most noteworthy pastors, receiving their Verse of the Day installments long before my alarm clock sounds, and pretty much check off my quiet time to do with a 60-second scroll through my tweets. With my phone handy, I never have to think. It tells me what to think. I don't even have to wonder what to think about because it tells me all the time. There is seemingly nothing this thing can't do, and all with just a little more than a swipe of my thumb, which is why I'm so attached, why we are so attached. I got to work a few days ago and realized I'd left my phone at home. The all-out search that proved futile and the ensuing overwhelming angst I experienced were significant. I think I was more distraught than if I'd misplaced one of my children. How am I going to get through this day without my phone? Fortunately, I found it in my computer bag, but not before I was reminded how utterly obsessed I am with my phone. I check that thing 100 times a day. Current research says it's actually 150. Swiping for the time, swiping for the weather, swiping to make a call. Most days, the biggest crisis I face has to do with keeping my cell phone charged. I think this is what we refer to as a first world problem. In addition to my handy smartphone, I have a giant television set at home that allows me access to more than 100 channels, and there is a stack of well over 200 DVDs just to its side. I justify this over-the-top investment by saying to myself, well, our family never goes out for entertainment, so we need something here at the house. It's true, but is being a gear hound okay? I've admitted that all this gear is very, very cool, and it is. But here's what I'm learning is not so cool. Becoming more fascinated with my stuff than with God. This is a problem not because I say so, but because God does. Come to me, he said in Matthew 11, verse 28, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. When God said that rest is found in him, he means that rest is found in him. Translation, real rest is found nowhere else. Recently, I heard a pastor in Maryland talking about the difference between amusement and rest. We tend to do one better than the other, and the one we do well is not rest. Case in point, last year my family and I went to Disney World for a full week, and I came back more exhausted than before I left. And I was really tired when we took off. I may have escaped the stressors of daily life, but had I even rested at all? This is what God is hinting at here, that restfulness is tethered to the state of our souls. We acknowledge that a healthy heart rhythm is critical for maintaining good health. A steady heartbeat is kind of necessary, right? What we are slower to admit is that our souls require rhythm too. All of us are aware that a healthy heart and regular daily and yearly rhythms are essential for health, wrote Dr. Christine Sine. We also know that if our heartbeat is irregular, then we need to see a physician for a checkup. Most of us, however, are unaware of the spiritual rhythms that are just as crucial to our health and well-being. Since our lives are increasingly disconnected from the rhythms of God's world, we do not hear the underlying whisper of God's heartbeat that is meant to sustain us, and we are unaware of the symptoms that should alert us to our growing ill health. She's right, you know. We don't hear the underlying whisper of God's heartbeat, most likely because we've always got wired buds in our ears. So when God says to us, come to me, and I will give you rest, we don't respond. God tries again. Lay your burdens down, children. Walk with me, and your walk will be burden-free. Again, we don't respond. God says, I want you to be fascinated, not with trinkets, but with me. Still, no response. Ever patient and ever persistent, God goes for it a fourth time. Slow down. Look up. Linger here with me. We think we hear something. Wait, was that the voice of God? We glance skyward and say, Huh, God? Was that you? What's linger? But before he has a chance to reply, we hear subtle dings from our phones, alerting us to new text messages. Then we can't help but move our thumbs across our phones. Score one for the enemy of our souls. Pursuing a calm and quiet soul. The world promises peace to us, but whatever nanosecond of restfulness or relief it offers is fragile, elusive, and circumstantial. It is also self-maintained. We must constantly find it, produce it, and keep it going, which causes us to work against what we seek. In reality, this isn't peaceful at all. It's the very opposite of peace. What we're craving is real-deal rest, rest that flows from the inside out. We're dying for this type of solace. How we wish we could simply stop. Which brings me to the usefulness of lollygagging. My son Abram is 15 now, and one of our favorite things to do is hang out at night in the hot tub behind our house. The Boyd home is situated on the Palmer Divide, a ridge north of Colorado Springs that has spectacular views in every direction. From any seat in the hot tub, you can see expansive flatlands to the east, a crush of ponderosa pines to the south, and crazy bright stars overhead. It's surreal. It's fantastic. It's our refuge most every night. Abram probably enjoys these times because it feels adventurous to be sitting outside in a tub of water with snow falling all around. Plus, despite what some parents report about the teenage years, Abram still relishes time with his dad. He loves it when he has me all to himself. I, on the other hand, enjoy the times for different reasons. For me, these are some of the only unrushed, unrestricted conversations I have with my son. It seems as though in life there was always a clock, always a place to be, a start time, a stop time, a deadline, an obligation, a frantic, hurry up, let's go, as everyone is herded out the door. But not so in the hot tub. In the hot tub, there is no clock. There's warm water, a wide sky, and a kid with 1,000 questions on his mind. Along the way, I've bought Abram cool toys, taken him on exciting trips, and given him scores of interesting opportunities to pursue. But maybe the best investment I've ever made is showing up with open ears and an open mind, being present with him. 10 or 20 years from now, when Abram is a grown man, what I'll miss more than anything are these hours spent fully engaged with him. Shooting the breeze, lollygagging, hanging out, father and son. I think God wishes for the same thing. A little lollygagging, a little engagement with his kids. It is God's presence that quiets our souls. It is God's presence that calms us down. This presence thing. Let me stay with this for a moment. I want you to think about two people in your life. The first being someone who seems preoccupied every time you're around them. You and I both have someone like this in our lives, someone who never quite seems to be listening as you talk, who never quite seems to be fully present when you get together for a cup of coffee, who never quite seems to pay attention when you honestly answer whatever question he just asked. This is the person who says, So, what were your plans again for this weekend? 45 minutes into a lunch date, because he wasn't listening when you answered that question for the first time, 40 minutes ago. Or the person who takes a call on his cell halfway through your emotional explanation of how your struggling teenager is doing these days, and explains away the indecency by saying, Oh, you gotta hold that thought. I've been waiting all morning for this guy's call. Okay, so you have that person's face in mind? Now, think about the most peaceful person you know. Maybe it's your spouse, or your mom, or a sibling, or colleague, or friend. For me, it's my longtime ministry mentor, Tom Lane. After my dad died nearly a decade ago, Tom became my father figure, and his easy confidence, his strong self-concept, and his deeply rooted passion for living like Christ instantly made me a better person. Tom is at peace in every sense of the word. He is at peace in his work, in his family life, in his walk with Jesus, and in his world. And this peace is absolutely contagious. I come away from time spent with Tom feeling as though I've been gulping extra amounts of oxygen. My spirits are lifted, my soul is settled, and my sense of optimism is restored. Interestingly, I found that most people tend to think of God as the first type of person, someone who is perpetually preoccupied, who doesn't really have time for them. We race into his presence, toss a few prayer bones in his way, and rush on to the next thing on our agendas, hoping something good or godly got attached to us, which will then carry us through the day. But this isn't at all how God works. God is not merely a peaceful person. God, in fact, is peace. When we sit in God's presence, we're sitting in the presence of peace. And when we sit there, actually stay there, quiet, still, we come away breathing differently. We come away with steadied souls. From there, astoundingly, we can become people of peace. We can become more like God. This is why God's invitation is so profound, the invitation to come to Him to find our rest. He can actually deliver on what He promises, something the world never will be able to do. I want this type of restfulness. I want to say yes to this. We slow down, to rest, to contemplate, to lollygag with God, because slow can pay serious dividends for our bodies, for our minds, and for our souls. Giving a new rhythm a try. On the night at the hospital when I woke and couldn't get back to sleep, days after my massive heart surgery, I felt a little like I was lollygagging with God. I didn't turn on the TV. I didn't crack open a book. I didn't even fret. I simply lay there in the presence of my Lord, totally unproductive, totally inefficient, and also totally and astoundingly at peace. Granted, I was somewhat of a captive audience, there in a hospital bed with scores of wires and tubes attached to every square inch of my body. But despite my captivity, I enjoyed our time together. I enjoyed simply sitting in the presence of God. It happened again recently, this swell of contentment, this sense of being delighted by the presence of God. Several weeks ago, I was asked to preach at a church in Charleston, South Carolina, for their Saturday evening and Sunday morning services. And with uncharacteristic deference to the state of my sagging soul, I decided to fly in a day early and simply spend time with God, to withdraw, to retreat, to give a new rhythm a try for once. This scheme required more than simply booking a flight for Friday instead of Saturday. In addition, I would need to stand my ground and protect my margin in half a dozen ways. No, I can't make the dinner Friday night. No, I also can't make the breakfast Saturday morning. No, I don't need someone from the church staff to show me around town Saturday afternoon. And on it went. I appreciated all the well-meaning offers I received, truly, but they were all potential saboteurs of my Sabbath state of mind. It's tempting for extroverts such as I to believe that these little yeses don't matter, and they don't add up to much in the end. But in fact, they do. I love how Wayne Muller put it. This one little conversation, this one extra phone call, this one quick meeting, what can it cost? But it does cost. It drains yet another drop of our life. Then, at the end of days, weeks, months, years, we collapse. We burn out and cannot see where it happened. It happened in 1,000 unconscious events, tasks, and responsibilities that seemed easy and harmless on the surface, but that each, one after the other, used a small portion of our precious life. I took Wayne's advice in South Carolina, and after enjoying a totally uneventful, totally obligation-free Friday night, I woke Saturday morning to still more hours of unscheduled time. I couldn't help but smile. I tugged on shorts and a t-shirt, laced up my running shoes, found the nearest trailhead to my hotel and took it, figuring I'd go wherever it went. The trail wound its way through a picturesque downtown area and up into a dense patch of trees. Here, the gravel gave way to dirt, the trail narrowed, and I could hear the crash of Atlantic waves up ahead. 45 minutes into my trek, I found myself standing before a dilapidated park bench that was positioned underneath a 100-year-old oak tree, whose long arms waved over scores of tombstones, marking lives lost in World War I. I took a seat and stretched out my legs. I took in the beauty surrounding me, breathing in the ocean's breeze. Officially, I was accomplishing nothing, but great gains were being made for my soul. It was then my gaze landed on the name carved into the tombstone positioned closest to me. It was an 18-year-old who had been placed in that grave, a young man who hailed from a different time. There were no cell phones in his day, no video games, no email, no Facebook, no TV. I'm sure he found distractions somewhere, but I had to wonder if it was easier to stay focused back then. I also wondered what he might say to me, if he could send me a message here and now. Would he tell me to treasure the days I have, because life may end sooner than I think? Would he tell me to slow my pace, to practice presence, to quit multitasking my hours away? I peered out over the ocean, taking in the layers of green, turquoise, and navy blue, the splendor of it all. The thought occurred to me that I couldn't have done this 10 years ago, taken this time, chosen this reprieve. I wouldn't have seen the point. I conceded that I may still eat too fast, talk too fast, walk too fast, and in general live by the code that says faster beats slower every time. But at least I was making progress. I had actually withdrawn from my daily chaos and parked myself on this rickety bench, lollygagging, fascinated with God. Living fascinated with God. Nearly every morning I am responsible for driving my daughter, Callie, to school. Her school is on my way to work, so it only makes sense for me to be the one to take her. Plus, it affords us some quality dad-daughter time. Except that Callie doesn't really do daddy-daughter time. Sure, she rides along, and she stays awake, and she breathes. But in terms of really engaging, of actually participating in our chat, I keep the bar pretty low. She has taught me to keep it low. As a result of my daughter's pensiveness, you might say, I tend to overtalk. You know, just to fill the void a little. A few months ago, when I first began writing this book, I decided to use a portion of our otherwise silent morning commute to practice living like a person at peace. The route from our home to Callie's school involves two quick left-hand turns, followed by going up a hill and then down the other side of the hill, followed by an absolutely stunning view of Pike's Peak. So each morning, as Callie and I made our way to her school, I'd comment on the state of Pike's Peak. This obviously required my actually looking at the mountain, which represented marked progress for me. "Wow, the peak sure looks majestic today," I'd declare. Or, "Callie, can you believe how the sun is reflecting off the peak this morning?" Or, "I'll never get used to the grandeur of that peak." A few weeks ago, Callie and I were in my truck en route to her school, and as usual, I made two left-hand turns before going up the hill and then down the hill. During our descent, I caught sight of the mountain and couldn't help myself. "Callie, do you realize it's the middle of May, and there is still all that snow at the top of Pike's Peak?" As usual, there was no reply. Well, no verbal reply, I should say. I cut my eyes to the right to be sure my daughter had heard my enthusiastic report, and in my periphery, I caught a dramatic eye roll as she turned toward the window and sighed. Yet again, I couldn't help myself. "What?" I asked good-naturedly. "Why the rolling of the eyes?" With no attempt at hiding her exasperation, she said, "Dad," her voice was huffy and she gave me a second eye roll, "you always have to say something about the peak." She let out yet another disgusted sigh and crossed her arms. "Every single day, you make some comment about the peak." I grinned. "Callie," I said in reply, "what's true about your dad is that he is absolutely fascinated with God. Or I want to be, anyway." Still nothing from the passenger seat. I went on. "This is my way of practicing that fascination, Callie, of practicing being fascinated with God. He put that mountain there. He put that snow on that mountaintop. And he invited me to have a look. You got to admit, that's pretty cool." Callie didn't say anything, but out of the corner of my eye, I detected a subtle grin. The sermonette I wanted to preach for Callie, but because of my better parental judgment I did not, was this. I don't experience much fear in life, but one fear I live with is that someday, in some way, I'll lose my fascination with God. I live with this fear because I've met this fear. I met it all those years ago when I was too distracted to be devoted to the one thing I said I loved most, God. And from first-hand experience, I can tell you that when one loses his or her fascination with God, there is nothing left to be fascinated with. Go ahead. Give it a try for a day. Decide not to be fascinated with God's creation, with God's people, even with God himself. And I guarantee by the time you put your head on the pillow that night, you'll be disillusioned, depressed, and cast down. This world without God is ugly, and people without God are fools. Some of them are fools even with God, but assuming you are viewing them through a godly lens, you can see past their idiocy and give them grace. Yes, I comment on the snow-capped mountain in front of us, and for very good reason. I don't want to miss a thing. Breaking busy. Challenge number one. Ditch the distractions. No surprise here. For one full day, 24 complete hours, turn off your phone. Or the radio in your car. Or ESPN. Whatever it is that distracts you from staying fascinated with God, let that thing rest for a day. Worry not. You don't have to ditch the distractions for a lifetime. I'm just suggesting that by untangling yourself from them for a day, you may realize just how tangled up you are, which is the first step toward making necessary change. Challenge number two. Tell God what you hope to find. As you power down your phone, your iPad, or your TV, take a few minutes to write out a prayer to God. What do you hope to discover about Him, about His creation, about His people, or about yourself as you engage in this one-day distraction fast? Maybe you want to hear His voice for the first time in a long time. Maybe you wish you could receive divine insight regarding a particular problem you've been facing. Maybe you hope to feel a sense of peace that has been lacking in your spirit for a while. Think through what you hope to find as you shut out distractions for a day. And then, candidly, tell God your thoughts. Part 2. Discovery. Calm or chaos? We get to choose. A bee is never as busy as it seems. It's just that it can't buzz any slower. Ken Hubbard. Chapter 4. Being Who We Are. Don't just do something. Stand there. Lewis Carroll. Just like them. The first time I experienced real restfulness in my spirit, it happened inadvertently. I was working at a church in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, in a role that felt pretty important. Although Southlake, Texas, was only 5 towns on the map from my previous Hereford residence, socioeconomically it was from here to the stars and back. A few years ago, Forbes magazine ranked the wealthiest suburbs in the country, and of course Southlake made the list. It topped the list, in fact, beating out the most affluent suburbs of New York, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. Today, even in a down economy, median household income there hovers just below $200,000, which represents more than 20% growth from census data 5 years ago. For a guy who grew up in less than lavish conditions, Southlake was a real eye-opener. On a near daily basis, I enjoyed lunch with businessmen and pastoral staffers from our church and other churches in the area at restaurants I couldn't have even worked at as a young man, let alone eaten at. It was opulence and ostentation like nothing I'd ever known. There was a lot to like about South Lake. People were so put together, so polished and sparkly clean, so different from dusty West Texas, not to mention from those murky Louisiana swamps. I spent my entire young adult life there in South Lake, trying ridiculously hard to impress the older men I knew. In my view, it was the older men in society who held the keys to money, prestige, and power, three things I really, really wanted. So even though I was half their age, I began to talk like them, walk like them, work like them, act like them, and look like them. I wanted them to see me as older and more mature than I was, and so I focused a great deal of energy on becoming that put together, just like them. I used to look at other guys my age who were sowing their wild oats, rebelling against the system, and blowing all their money and time and think, "What fools! Can't they see they're jeopardizing their entire future?" No, I was far too ambitious to goof around playing games. My heart condition probably played a key role here. Docs had forecasted an abbreviated life for me, and I figured if the clock was ticking, I'd better cram in as much as I could, as fast as I could, before my limited time ran out. If that meant becoming a 60-year-old at age 30, then so be it. I'd carefully crafted a new persona, and was committed to keeping it afloat. Who needed authenticity when money, prestige, and power surely were about to be mine? We do this, you know. We spin and whir and run and race, and then at last look up from all that speed and see we've become someone we never wanted to be. Sir Walter Scott of Rob Roy and Ivanhoe fame started one of his poems this way. "Breathes there the man with soul so dead." On this subject of running ourselves through insane paces in the name of impression management, his words pretty much say it all. Even in the 1800s, it must have been evident we can get caught up in stuff that doesn't matter in the end. We're breathing, yes, but are our souls even remotely alive? Last fall, I had the privilege of spending a couple of days with Eugene Peterson at his home in Montana. He's a personal hero of mine, so it was time well spent. Ridiculously well spent, actually. I came away with more wisdom and insight than I could ever hope to excavate. But here's one thing that he mentioned that I'll remember for a long, long time. He said, "I can go anywhere. I can do anything. I can buy anything money can buy. But you know what? I don't have the appetite for it. I'm content here and now with this life." He waved an open palm around the living room, indicating his immediate surroundings, yes, but also his life in general. Eugene Peterson lived in relative obscurity until he was 65 years old, which is when he published his paraphrase of the Bible, The Message. Millions of copies were soon sold, and he was famous in the span of a year. But the fame and the financial gain did not own him. That's what he was saying that day. "It's fine, but it doesn't own me." In his book, Reversed Thunder, Peterson said that when God's kingdom comes, we will have all we need. But as great as that reality will be, there is something greater still, which is that we will only want exactly what we have. We will live from the place called enough. By being content with what he had, by only wanting what he already had, Eugene was practicing future happiness. In his own way, he was ushering in a bit of heaven right here on planet Earth. He was practicing being alive in an eternal sense. His heart wasn't merely beating. His soul was alive as well. Daring to be me. What I refused to grasp during those early days at Gateway was that tucking myself behind a facade every day, making sure none of the real me could be seen, is terribly exhausting work. By allowing the shiny, successful people in my life to dictate my pace instead of trusting God to take care of that role, I was unwittingly denying myself rest. Letting ourselves be who we really are is a key step in living a life at rest. It is when we free ourselves from the inner vows we've made, the ones that keep us spinning, worrying, running, racing, that we take our first steps toward rest. When we allow ourselves to cease living by our self-imposed declarations of what we'll do and not do, I will not be poor, I will not be insignificant, I will matter, I will make a name for myself, I will make my family proud, I will finish what I started, I will outshine my superstar brother, I will be a perfect mom and a perfect employee, I will look right and dress right and be the one to have it all. We discover what real living is: nearness to Christ, newness in Christ, choosing to walk at His pace. God began to reveal these truths to me while I was still on staff at Gateway, and the freedom I felt was overwhelming. I could be me, and that's enough. One tangible shift that occurred immediately had to do with the ministry schedule I kept. When I was consumed with keeping up with the older men on our staff, I often neglected the needs of my family for the sake of being present at events at the church. But being me, the real me, meant acknowledging the priority my wife and two young kids held in my heart. And so from that moment forward, if something was going on at the church that I really didn't have to be part of, I'd beg off, explaining to my superiors that I had a prior commitment. Occasionally, my colleagues would probe, and I'd have to explain that the commitment involved hanging out with my kids, both of whom were less than 5 years old at the time. One of the other pastors on staff used to razz me for this. "Must be nice to have a built-in excuse," he'd say with something approaching a sneer, to which I'd respond, "They're not an excuse. They're kids who crave time with their dad." I couldn't blame him for giving me a hard time. For so long, I was the guy standing in judgment of anyone and everyone who didn't appear to be working as hard and as long as I did, people who had the audacity to take time off or call a workday complete as soon as their 8 hours were up. When you need to be needed, you'll willingly sign up for slavery like that. We are so very busy. Give this a try. The next 10 people you see face to face, pose the question, "How you been lately?" And then count how many times you hear this in response: "Busy. So busy." I'm willing to bet you'll go 10 for 10. What's not discussed in these "I'm so busy it would blow your mind" discussions is the motivation for all that busyness. I have a theory on this, which is that busyness is our means to impress. If I'm busy, then I'm important. And if I'm important, then you'll be impressed, right? Don't you do this too? A buddy calls you up and asks about having lunch sometime soon, and instead of answering succinctly, you feel compelled to give him the rundown of your very busy, very important week. "Well, I've got an off-site all-day Monday. I'm in wall-to-wall meetings on Tuesday. Wednesday is an extended morning session with the board, and Thursday, well, it's already in the tank." Seriously, why couldn't you just say no? Or, at a minimum, why couldn't you say, "What a kind offer. You know, I could swing Friday this week, or else would something early next week work for you?" Here's why you can't say that. Because that is not an impressive reply. And boy, how we love to impress. Busyness serves as a kind of existential reassurance, a hedge against emptiness, one author wrote. Obviously, your life cannot possibly be silly or trivial or meaningless if you are so busy, completely booked, in demand every hour of the day. We buy more house than we can afford. We elevate vacation stories to epic proportions. We proudly tout our stuffed full schedules, and we refuse to let others see us rest. Oh, the things we do in the name of impression management. We all want to be important. We all want our little lives to count. And yet we're going about it in entirely the wrong way. All the posing and posturing and performing may help you hit the quota, win the award, and be the guy who saves the day. But in terms of encouraging the stuff of righteousness, it won't even get you to step one. Jesus said that all our boasting may get us some things, but it won't get us the one thing we truly seek, which is the soul-filling love of our Father, the sense that we're acceptable as we are. Everything in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, comes not from the Father, but from the world. 1 John 2, verse 16. In the Gospel of Matthew, we are told not to be like the hypocrites, who love to pray to be seen by people, who love to flaunt their spirituality and their superiority, who love to devote themselves to trying to impress. No, instead, Jesus says we are to work on the inner self, spending our energies developing things such as a gentle spirit, which according to 1 Peter 3, verse 4, is of great worth in God's sight. A gentle spirit, something we humans can't cultivate on the go. Along the way, my family and I sort of institutionalized the practice of ditching impression management and working toward a quiet, gentle spirit instead. Once a week, we'd hole away for an entire day with nothing on the agenda and nobody to impress. We would wake when our bodies were done sleeping instead of being jolted by a blaring alarm. We'd ignore the hands on the clock and open our own hands to an unscheduled day. We'd eat when we got hungry, move when we got antsy, rest when we got weary, and let the day come to us instead of maniacally chasing it down. Smartphones weren't the rage yet, but desktop computers were, and we took pains to keep ours shut down, to experience life not virtually but firsthand, here in real time. Mostly, we puttered. We ambled. Once a week, beautifully, we took a long, slow stroll through our day. Evelyn Underhill once said, "Hurry and impatience are sure marks of the amateur." If she's right, and I think she is, then once a week, we Boyds were total pros. On Bedhead Days, Be Lazy. Bedhead Days, we came to call them, these times of extricating ourselves from the clutches of busy and intentionally focusing on rest. We didn't have any rules on our Bedhead Days. In fact, rules would have mucked up everything. If there were three guiding principles that emerged over time, they were be lazy, be together, and give grace. Suffice it to say, the most obvious things I rested from on those Bedhead Days were the clock, the calendar, and the ever-pressing need to go, go, go. But just as important was my practice of resting from people's expectations of me. I've always been pegged as a driver personality, and as such, I have enjoyed being known as the action-oriented one, the can-do one, the solution-seeking one, the guy who is responsible and reliable and strong and generally in charge. I like all these roles because they convince me I'm bringing value to the world. Surely you can relate. Maybe you're the optimistic one, or the one who always organizes social gatherings, or the one who is great at fundraising, or the one who always remembers snacks. Maybe you're the sparkling conversationalist, or the steady listener, or the master of little-known facts, or the bleeding heart. Whatever your role may be, you probably like playing that role. We tend to attach our self-worth to these roles, but on a Bedhead Day, it's time to lay them down. It's time to rest from our roles and bask in the fact that we're loved for who, not what, we are. This is a terrifying and also marvelous thing to do, by the way. I dare you to try it. Just for a few hours, lay down all the stuff others think about you, all the roles you're asked to play. See if that newfound nakedness suits you. I guarantee you'll relish your stripped-down state. Every January, our church engages in 21 days of prayer and fasting as a way to kick off the new year in a contemplative way. During week 2 of the endeavor this year, a dear woman approached me following one of the prayer meetings and asked if she could have a word with me. She is a longtime New Lifer, a faithful servant, and someone who has been nothing but encouraging to me since my first week on the job. but this time, her encouragement soared to new heights. She was several minutes into her monologue of praise regarding my preaching, my teaching, my leadership, and my general greatness as a human being, when I realized that she wasn't describing me at all. Sure, she was describing her ideal of me, but the description was not me. When she finished her well-meaning speech, I thanked her for her graciousness and kindness, for believing the very best about me. But privately, silently, I told myself to take it for what it was, a compliment and nothing more. There are two traps I tend to fall into regarding other people's opinions of me. The first is the pride trap. I can take people's affirmations of me and use them to inflate my self-assessment, my worth. I can become prideful and boastful and haughty and self-righteous and be a total jerk to be around. Or, on the other end of the spectrum, I can use others' input as a performance bar I have to clear. I can let insecurity and the need to please eclipse everything else, and I can subsequently throw my energies at living up to the standard they've set for me. Both of these traps were tempting landing spots as I listened to that sweet woman pour on the praise. But an interesting thing happened en route to one of those two miry pits. I stayed steady right there in between. I received her compliment without letting it puff out my chest or deflate my self-concept. I took it for what it was and moved on. Interestingly, I had enjoyed a bedhead day the day before that conversation, and I firmly believe that because I had spent the previous 24 hours resting, yes, from the clock, but also resting from people's expectations of me, I was able to respond with maturity and grace. See if you find this to be true as you make strides toward living rhythmically. The more rested you are, the less you are driven by what others think of you. The more rested you are, the more you are driven by what God alone believes to be true. This is a magnificent place to be, because Scripture is clear that God's thoughts toward us are good. This brings me to what all this rest is for. We rest not just to be caught up on sleep, or to build up our immune systems, or to keep our bones healthy and strong, although all these things do happen as a result. We also rest for a deeper purpose, the purpose of meditating on the things of God, His character, His creation, His come-to-me promise, the realest of real invitations to rest. Sleeping in, a long walk, watching the wind blow by, a picnic lunch, pushing your kid on a swing, reading 10 pages of a good novel, savoring a piece of dark chocolate, mowing your lawn slowly while listening to the Eagles' greatest hits. There are 1,000 ways to push pause on the rush, to inject a little lazy into even the craziest of weeks. On bedhead days, be together. A second guiding principle for us Boyds was easier to practice than the first, be together. We love to be together, so this was a sort of given in our lives already. But still, as weeks turned into months and months turned into years and our kids grew up and outgrew their need to be no more than 6 feet from mom and dad, it was important for us to reinforce the importance of togetherness. Sometimes we're reminded the hard way, as was the case for one guy on board during the Miracle on the Hudson event. In the middle of the afternoon on January 15, 2009, U.S. Airways Flight 1549 took off from LaGuardia Airport in New York City, bound for Charlotte, North Carolina. It was supposed to be an uneventful flight. But 3 minutes into the plane's ascent, passengers realized they were in for a wild ride. The captain, Chesley Sully Sullenberger, came over the intercom with a 3-word request: brace for impact. Evidently, upon takeoff, the plane had struck a flock of Canada geese, which took out both engines in one fell swoop. Air traffic controllers directed the captain toward nearby Teterboro Airport in New Jersey, but there wasn't enough time to get there. Captain Sullenberger chose the nearest runway he could find to land the plane, the middle of the Hudson River. As expected, the 150 passengers aboard the plane put their heads in their laps and began to pray. I don't know about you, but I'd be praying too. When you're in a plane that suddenly goes silent, and you see nothing but freezing cold water below, the only natural reaction is to pray. And fast. One of those prayers that day was Puerto Rican businessman Rick Elias. He lived to tell his story, thanks to some crafty maneuvering from the captain of the flight, who ditched the plane into the river in such a way that every single person survived, all but two without any injury whatsoever. But the crash was still harrowing, and in the minutes it took to actually reach the river, Elias did some deep, if not quick, soul-searching. You can learn a lot about people based on how they respond in a crisis, which is why I find his takeaway so interesting. In that moment, he said, I regretted the time I wasted on things that did not matter with people that matter. There it is, the importance of togetherness. We matter more than stuff ever will. And yet still, this is the tendency, isn't it? To prioritize the insignificant over the significant. To put people in line after things. We run around like crazed Marthas, forgetting entirely that it was Mary whom Jesus praised. We do this, I think, because things can be controlled, but people cannot. Things can be accomplished. People are never complete. Things can be kept neat and clean. People are messy every day of their lives. And so we opt for the tidier, more predictable path. To insist on togetherness, at least once a week anyway, was for us Boyds a way of saying to one another, yes, I know you're messy and disheveled and sometimes annoying and quirky and rude, but I'm in. I'm in because I can be all those things too, and just as desperately, I need people in my life who will love me anyway. On Bedhead Days, give grace. And then a third guideline, give grace. Last week, my assistant Lex asked me if I was still working on a book about rest. She'd eyed my calendar on her computer screen mere moments before, which told me it was a loaded question. I am, I said with a knowing grin, to which she replied, so your plan is to start living what you're preaching after you write the book? Laughing, I turned to walk back into my office, but not before saying, grace, Lex, grace. Despite my intentions regarding a once weekly bedhead day, there are weeks when my careful plan doesn't pan out. In those instances, I practice giving myself grace. Rest isn't an obligation. It's a gift. More on this topic in Chapter 8. Mark Buchanan wrote, "The rest of God is not a reward for finishing. It's not a bonus for work well done. It's sheer gift." As often as I possibly can, I receive that gift with open arms. But sometimes life presents obstacles that are unavoidable, and the gift sits there, still beautifully wrapped. A month ago, a massive wildfire overtook our local news coverage and our very lives, and our church was converted to a Red Cross shelter to house displaced residents from area neighborhoods. I was helping staff the shelter with a team of new lifers, making sure evacuees had food and bottles of water and warm blankets and sturdy cots, all on the day that was my bedhead day for the week. Still, I knew I was where I needed to be, even as my day of rest was usurped. As I put my head on my pillow that night, I thought about how grateful I was for the progress I'd made over the years with regard to living a rhythmic life. This fire was a bona fide emergency, but there was a time in my life when I wouldn't have perceived it as such. Back then, I was living as though all of life were an emergency, and consequently never saw real crises for what they were, deviations from the norm, not the norm itself. I was learning, wasn't I? Against all odds, I was becoming something of a Sabbath keeper. Not a perfect one, admittedly, but one who practiced anyway. Astonishing material and revelation appear in our lives all the time, Anne Lamott once said. Let it be. Unto us so much is given. We just have to open for business. Breaking busy. Challenge number one. Call impression management what it is. Self-help writers and well-meaning pastors alike proclaim the virtues of living authentic lives, of being ourselves, of letting down our guard, of forgetting about what others think. And while it is true that living in this manner does great things for our minds and hearts, it doesn't change the fact that it's a really difficult way to live. Most of us have carefully architected walls surrounding us that don't get demolished overnight. No, we've established these habits because we feel safe here, inside our intentionally crafted facades. We like managing others' impression of us. We like being our own PR rep. And yet, if we were honest, we'd have to admit that keeping up appearances is an exhausting way to live. On a sheet of paper, or in your journal, note the habits you maintain for the sheer sake of impression management. Maybe you insist on yours being the first car in the parking lot at your place of employment, or on having the latest, most fashion-forward clothes, or on driving the cleanest, most powerful car, or on being up to date on breaking news every day. If you're a woman, maybe you never leave the house without makeup on, even to run to the grocery store. Be honest with yourself as you log these habits. What is it I always do so that others will be impressed by me? Challenge number 2. Give a bedhead day a try. Next, give a bedhead day a try. If your list of impression management habits is lengthy, you may short-circuit the idea of tabling all of them for a full day. But perhaps you can choose one or two of them. Getting to work early, for example, instead of coming in on time. Or else dressing to the nines, just to attend a casual outing with your family, and determine to let them go for a day. Then, throughout the day, take note of how you feel in your spirit when you're not utterly consumed with what others may think. Chapter 5. Shabbat Shalom. The day, Sabbath, is thick with peace. Marianne McKibben Dana. Rest is made for us. I love to travel. Always have and probably always will. I love eating food items I don't normally eat, seeing sights I don't normally see, and traipsing about foreign lands. I love seeing how people do life on the other side of the planet and having my horizons expanded and enriched as I go. Here's what's also true. I always love coming home. I love coming home because in my home, everything is just so. The foods I like are there, and they are right where I like them to be. The pillow I like is there, and it is always on my side of the bed. The closet